and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Classrooms for Climate Conference hosted by Chugach National Forest and the University of Alaska Anchorage. Recorded on May 4th at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, listen to public radio producer Majora Carter's keynote address entitled Hometown Security, Climate Adaptation, Social Innovation, and Local Solutions. That's coming up on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news. You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. This week's show was recorded at the Classrooms for Climate Conference held at UAA on May 4th.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Fran Ulmer, and I'm the former chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage, and tonight also with us is the current chancellor of UAA, Tom Case.
And good evening.
Good evening, I'm Terry Marceron, Forest Supervisor on the Chugach National Forest.
And we're both very happy to bring to you the Classrooms for Climate Conference and Majora Carter.
So this is a very special year for the Chugach National Forest and the University of Alaska Anchorage. It's the International Year of Forests, a time to celebrate the actions of individuals, private organizations, government agencies, and communities working to sustainably manage and conserve the world's forests. Tonight, we celebrate by launching our shared Classrooms for Climate Symposium. This is a conference that will bring together diverse climate-related research, monitoring, and projects encompassing the Chugach National Forest and neighboring landscapes. Over the next few days, you'll hear over 100 presenters. You'll hear about the changing glaciers on the Chugach National Forest, our most northerly forest, and how that affects sea levels. We'll listen to the future of our city's water source, the state of green jobs in Alaska, and how we're monitoring changes in critical salmon habitat. And you'll also hear recommendations about the future related to research and adaptation. And we're also going to hear from youth participating in the Northern Forum's Youth Eco Forum. Now, they're out here in the audience. Can you guys raise and tell us where you are? Come on, cheer up. Where are you?
You know, the Chugach National Forest and the University of Alaska Anchorage have a lot in common. We share a very similar geographic area. And we also are very committed to engaging young people, both in the forests and in the university, in getting to know your own neighborhood and learning through science and discovery how you can not only get to know it better, but how you can contribute to your communities. We share a desire to engage our young people in understanding what is in the world around them and making better use of our environment in productive ways. What our keynote speaker tonight will talk to us about is how important it is that we take that first step as individuals to get to know our communities, to get to know our environment. That's what Majora Carter did. She discovered her path by reclaiming her own backyard. Majora Carter has done some pretty amazing things. She has created the nation's first urban green-collar job training and placement system. She's created her own consulting firm. Yes, it's cool. And she has her own public radio show, The Promised Land. She also has obtained many awards and a lot of recognition for what she's done. And she's been labeled some really interesting titles, like the Green Power Broker and the Prophet of Local. But mostly what Majora Carter does is connect people with a sense of place and turn that into some powerful ways to change the world. Please welcome Majora Carter.
I just got actually some of the nicest news just before that. Terry, who you just heard from before. Okay, I may look like, you know, an inner city girl, which I am, you know, born and bred, but I also have this great love of the outdoors and actually bringing, you know, fabulous wild things all around me. I actually have, you know, we compost in our backyard. We have a little garden. We have bees. We keep bees as well. And we actually want to support bat habitat in our own backyard. And I just found out that Terry put together a whole list of resources to make sure that we have the best bat house ever in the world. So thank you very much for that, Terry. So, but what I really want to talk with you all about, you know, is the fact that, you know, what I did, you know, what we did with our backyard, and actually it was mostly my husband who did it. I just kind of watched. But the whole idea is that you don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. But what we've discovered, you know, what I think, you know, history has shown is that the, you know, different places, you know, depending on who you are, your class, your race, sometimes those places are not as nice as others are. And so I tell this story, you know, as a way to kind of help folks see that there's a path in many cases to how you can really develop what you want, you know, in your own community. And that, you know, regardless of how you get there, that nothing is impossible. And I want to show you with a little bit of my story. So I'm going to start actually long before I was born, back in the late 1940s, when there was a great migration, you know, of black folks, you know, that moved up north, you know, in search of their own great American dream. You know, my parents were from Georgia and South Carolina. They ended up settling, you know, in a place called Hunts Point, which was part of the South Bronx in New York City. And at the time, it was a mostly white working class community. You know, and literally my neighborhood was a walk to work neighborhood, which meant that there was a residential center and on the outside of it was the industrial core. And people would walk to work into their, you know, manufacturing jobs. My neighborhood actually had so much steel going on there that it was often called Little Pittsburgh. Folks like, you know, my parents, you know, blacks from down south followed suit, and then later on, folks from the Caribbean, starting with Puerto Rico, also came up. And then we had white flights, which meant when black folks moved in, white folks moved out. We also were experiencing the highway construction boom all over the country. And in the Bronx, in New York City, we unfortunately had the problem of being located between two very wealthy counties, Westchester to our north and Manhattan to our south. So it meant that, you know, what was mostly a pretty working class community, you know, in the Bronx was just sort of got in the way in between these two areas. So places, you know, we developed this spaghetti network of highways, and people were literally given often less than a month's notice before they were told they had to leave because a highway was going to be built through their community. And this is not the first financial crisis we've been in. Freedom, for some young people that might seem really weird, but there were plenty of others, and this was an especially big one. Back in the 1970s, banks and other financial institutions literally drew red lines around areas where they were not going to make any kind of financial investment. And so what happens if you need a loan to fix up your property and you don't get it and there's no other way to really make those kind of improvements? It's going to fall into disrepair. And oh, this is around the time that I came in. But this is what I grew up with. Remember, there was no way to get financial investment or loans, you know, other kind of things to fix up your properties. So landlords found it, and other property owners found it much more profitable to torch their own buildings, literally commit arson, to collect insurance money, rather than to count on money that was not coming in from other kind of, you know, financial services. So this is, you know, what I grew up with. You know, in many different cases, this was not uncommon in any area at all. We ended up losing about 60% of the population in our community because of the combination, you know, highway construction, arson, et cetera. And I remember growing up in my community, and you know, my neighborhood literally was a national symbol for urban blight. Like, this was a place where nothing good could happen. No one great came from this place. And so I grew up seeing this on the nightly news as a place where there was crime and drugs and all sorts of really bad, bad things like that. And it was often referred to in the same breath as a war zone. And I remember that there was actually a war, you know, that had happened just during the time I was little in Vietnam. And my brother had actually spent two separate tours in Vietnam. And he did come back home, but he was killed a few months after he came back because of a drug war in the next neighborhood over. So all of that, type of different types of financial disinvestment, you know, and really bad urban planning kind of paved the way for many of the environmental problems that we were later to experience as a community. Remember the manufacturing? Well, organized crime got involved in waste handling. And so many of those places that actually housed different types of manufacturing companies became huge garbage facilities. And then later on came the sewage treatment plants, and later on the power plants. And all in literally one square mile area. And so it's not just that these different types of environmental problems were just not nice to have around and they smelled bad or whatever. I mean, these were all very fossil fuel based problems, and they had some pretty severe impacts on our health. We learned just a few years ago, or got proof a few years ago, that proximity to fossil fuel emissions causes learning disabilities in young children, making it more difficult for them to just to learn. And so where do you find those type of fossil fuel emitting facilities? You find them generally closer to poor communities, if not in poor communities. And we know statistically that poor kids who go to poor schools in poor neighborhoods have a much easier chance of going straight into jail than onto higher education in a place like this. So it's like we were, you know, our policies were creating these wonderful, easy pathways directly into prison rather than into prosperity. We also, because of the fossil fuel emissions, had a lot of problems with respiratory problems as well. We have one of the country's highest childhood asthma hospitalization rates. Diabetes and obesity, people may not think that it is directly related to environmental issues. However, partially food access or lack thereof is definitely related to it. But the other part, you know, if parents are worried, you know, that their kids will get hit by a truck, or if they're already suffering from respiratory problems, they're probably not going to let them go outside and play and get the kind of regular physical activity that most kids do. And so, you know, what we did back in, you know, I have to tell you something starting now, little confession that I have to make. I actually do have something in common with the Tea Party. And no, I do not believe that I needed to see the president's long-form birth certificate to know that he was in fact a citizen of this country. It's that I actually believe that we should have a smaller government. And the way that I want to see us have a smaller government is by providing jobs for our most expensive citizens. And so who are our most expensive citizens? Our most expensive citizens are, you know, folks that are generationally impoverished, you know, people that cycle in and out of the criminal justice system, people that are coming back from our wars, veterans. And these are folks, group of people, who actually use, for their use, a larger percentage of social service dollars than many other Americans. And the issues of, and the fact that we've got people that tend to, you know, self-medicate to just deal with their own stress, that they have plenty of other public health problems that they have to deal with, that their kids don't do as well in school, which brings up a whole host of other problems. There's even, you know, higher rates of domestic violence. And so you have folks that are using this disproportionate amount of social service dollars, and they're not necessarily getting better. So I'm really interested in seeing us get jobs for folks that are in that predicament, and in particular in green infrastructure. And I'll say a little bit more about that, going forward. But, I'm from a place where we do have a lot of those most of America's most expensive citizens. And, it's that's where I started my career. It's where I still live in places where people, aren't, where they don't have a lot of choice to do a whole lot of other things. And, so this is a place that, I was born and raised in and really grew to love. But at first, like I told you before, I grew up watching my neighborhood on the nightly news. I was not happy about being there. I was ashamed of the place. I did everything that I could to leave and never return. Problem with that was that the universe had another plan for me. I walked away, went away to college. I knew I was a smart kid, that was gonna happen. And then I got into graduate school and I was broke and I had a really demanding course load, which meant that I had to move back in with my mommy and daddy. Yeah, and I was the youngest of 10 kids. I'm sure they were very happy to see me back, but that's a whole other story. But later on, we all were very happy to be together. But at first, it was not a happy thing, especially for me. It was quite a defeat. But the beautiful thing about my having to come back to the neighborhood was that I actually got to see my neighborhood in a completely different light. I got a little bit of education and some distance, which helped me see that not everybody, lives the same way that our community did. And I found out that our city and state were planning on building this huge waste facility on our waterfront because we already handled about 40% of our city's commercial waste. This would bring another 40% of the waste to our little square mile community. And, so the community we got actively engaged in helping to encourage our city to think about a better way of handling its waste that did not disproportionately discriminate against poor communities of color, which was what they did because it was politically expedient to do so. We were a really vulnerable population, but politically vulnerable, which meant it was easy to dump on us. So the community got really hip to this, and they were not happy. And so we worked to help the city see better than what they did. And so we did. We actually won that battle. And over the course of a few years, was able to help the city see that there was a much better way to do solid waste in our community. But what really kept me going in this community, or in this work, was this dog. Actually, this is a photo from an actual magazine. The article is actually about her. It's not really about me. I just show it up for the picture. But Zena was a dog that I found tied up, in the rain one night. She was a 20-pound, bit of a monster, just like totally crazy. And she grew into this 80-pound thing. And but it was around the time that I got her, we were fighting against the waste facility, but I also got these really interesting notices from a program that was run through the U.S. Forest Service, and actually some support from Fish and Wildlife and National Park Service, and they just went together to really help urban communities really work toward their own environmental equality. And so I kept getting these notices, and they were touting that you can get a little seed grant to do work on the Bronx River. And I was like, this is really great, I'm glad you're doing this, but you really don't know my neighborhood because you cannot get to the river from my neighborhood. There's too much waste facilities and stuff all on our waterfront. I knew we had one, I'd just never seen it. And at that time, my 30 years. And but I got this dog, and she literally took me jogging into what I thought was just another illegal garbage dump in our community. And it was. What I didn't know, and I have my dog to thank for this, was because she pulled me into this area that was literally piled high up over my head with decades worth of construction and demolition debris. So there were tires and just nastiness, and there were crack vials and hypodermic needles and just everything that you did not want to be in. And I couldn't believe I was there, except that I had an 80-pound canine in front of me who I thought at least would protect me. So, but the beautiful thing was at the end of this dump was the Bronx River. And I'd never seen it. And as long as I didn't focus at all on the dump that was behind me and just looked out at the river, and I remember it like it was yesterday. It was this beautiful, beautiful day, and the sunlight was glinting off the water, and there was all this, and it looked like these gold, like little birds were flying up out of the water, and I just could not believe that this was my neighborhood. I'd never seen anything more beautiful in my entire life. And so, of course, I went home, dragged Zena, and went and actually wrote this little seed grant and started working. And working for me meant, you tell everybody about what you think this dump could become. that it could be a jewel if we really work to make it happen. So I spoke with folks, you know, people who did, you know, help do cleanups all over the place. I spoke to business leaders. I spoke to our city. And we were able to leverage that little grant into this here park. And this, thank you. And this park, you know, has become just an absolute jewel, I think, in New York City. We've never had anything this beautiful, you know, in our community. And being from a place where we were told that nothing beautiful could ever be there or come from there, to have a park that has actually won national awards, you know, be in a place like this is a really powerful, powerful thing to have in our local community. And I actually did get married there, you know, back in 2006 with Zena as my flower girl. but it wasn't just a beautiful place to get married. I mean, it really was, and I hope many, many more do the same thing. But what it really did was inspire our community to think about what else we could have. I mean, we'd been told so often that there was nothing of value in our community, and suddenly we created something of value. And, you know, to all of us, that meant a lot to us and anybody who was looking. And so we were like, well, what else? And so someone told me about this federal transportation grant that was providing money to do studies for projects that involved non-motorized vehicular transportation. So I found out about Greenways, which is dedicated bikes and pedestrian walkways, and thought we could do this here. If we can do, you know, a Greenway in the South Bronx that will connect the parks in the future, as well as dedicated on-street bike paths. And this would actually create some opportunities, you know, for us to create more economic developments that were consistent with this type of development, like a more park-friendly use, or that we could even use it to create more environmentally friendly neighborhoods. The fact that it would absorb stormwater, things like this, these are climate adaptation strategies as well. So this is the street that leads further down, you know, into the park I just showed you a little bit earlier. And this is what it's going to look like as we start spending the $50 million that we raised in order to start building, you know, the first several of the 11-mile network of the Greenway. And I'm really excited because a good portion of that money, more than $20 million, came from the economic stimulus package because it was a shovel-ready project. And as far as I know, I think it's actually one of the few around the country that is literally designed, you know, for a pedestrian-friendly use rather than motorized vehicles, which makes me very proud. And this is the construction in action, which makes I've never loved construction more than actually seeing this thing happen in my neighborhood. And I love, like, walking by the guys and introducing myself and them saying, thanks very much, we needed the work. I'm like, I know, so it's all good. But the thing that because I've seen it happen, I mean, so much about my work is all about expecting, you know, folks to recognize that they've got value that then they could then share. And so, but in a community like ours, when we're told, you're nothing special, as a matter of fact, you're less than special, that's kind of hard to do. Couple that, you know, with the fact that we were told that we had no environment, you know, in our inner city. It's certainly not any worth protecting. And so for us, we had to really help our community members have both a personal as well as a financial stake in our own community and in the environment as it got better. And the other thing was, as we worked to restore our waterfront, we realized that the city kept bringing in people to do that work, even though we had about a 25% unemployment rate. So it seemed to us like we need to train people to do this work, and then we could hire them locally. So we first started getting them doing job training in ecological restoration, but first starting with wetland restoration, riverine restoration, and then later moving on into urban forestry management and learning how to clean up contaminated lands and even green roofing, you know, installation as well. And the idea behind this was that, you know, we would train, you know, the people in our community, you know, with these hard skills in ecological restoration, but also give them the soft skills that they needed. Because so many of the folks that went through our program were generationally impoverished. You know, folks that were in and out of the criminal justice system, or, you know, ex-felons. And, you know, in many cases, the same folks that had never seen a family member with a job before, or at least not one in the legitimate economy. So we had to really train them, you know, and how do you be a leader, you know, in your own life? You know, how do you be a team player? You know, how do you show your boss that you are capable and dependable and all this stuff? And some of that was just as simple as like making sure that you always looked busy when your boss was around. You know, if you didn't know how to do stuff like that, you know, why would you? It's like, I'm finished with my work. I'm standing around. No, you're not. You're going to make you some work. And that's how you be valuable. But these are things that we had to teach these folks. And I think one of the things that I'm so proud of was that 85% success rate. You know, these were folks who had been written off, you know, practically since the day they were born. And suddenly, because of the kind of skills that we gave them, they were able to understand that they could be real producers, you know, in the development of their community in a way that actually not only put money in their pocket, but pride in their hearts. And that, I think, was just a powerful thing to give to folks that didn't know that they had that to offer. Another thing we wanted to do was show that, you know, there was the green itself also meant this kind of green, you know, money green, and that it wasn't just about, you know, like Birkenstock wearing tree huggers, which is, you know, I like trees and I like Birkenstocks too, but if you wear them. But the whole idea is that, you know, we really did have to show that this was about how do you create businesses? How do you do local economic development so that money can actually stay in your own community? And so we started a green roof installation business. We took a model that has been used in Western Europe for a sustainable building technique that had been used in Western Europe for more than 50 years, where you literally plant a roof. With structured soil medium and certain types of plants, you know, for all of the environmental services that they provide, everything from stormwater management, you know, they literally retain between 75% to 90% of the water that falls on them, depending on the plants. They provide a green layer, which means that it cleans the air quite naturally. And if you have enough of them, they literally help reduce the ambient temperature, you know, in your cities, because it which means that you're actually using less energy, especially in the summer for air conditioning. And they make your roof last a lot longer than a traditional, you know, bituminous or asphalt roof as well. And so what we're doing, and also these are jobs, none of which can be outsourced. It's not like you're going to send your roof, you know, overseas, you know, in order to do that. It's right here, and that money stays in your local economy. So what we're doing here, or I don't know why I was up there, but anyway, what the guys are doing here is literally planting, you know, seedlings, you know, on top of the roof, and doing some cuttings as well. And my upstairs neighbor literally came to see what everybody was doing, and this is what it looks like now, you know, a couple years later. So it's created this. It's really wonderful, you know, blanket of pretty little sedum plants that I just love that literally stopped the flooding, you know, in my house. So that's really why we got that. We also wanted to show that there are many different types of green roofs that you can do all sorts of things on them that are literally you only are hemmed in by the structural integrity of your rooftops. You can grow trees on it if you want to, but we just wanted to show like a couple different things. Like you can do a medicinal herb garden, you know, even urban agriculture on top of your roof. And these were the best strawberries that anyone would ever eat, and we grew them literally on top of my old office's headquarters. And we also got to visit. We also got these visitors. You know, it was so cool. And I'm pretty sure it's a hawk, and I'm happy that there are plenty of birders in here who could tell me if it's not. But anyway, we thought it was a hawk, and we named it Harry, and I called it Hank. So we're not saying that these type of green infrastructure projects, you know, the urban forestry management or the green roof, you know, because they attract and absorb stormwater, that they ever will completely, you know, negate the need for these kind of municipal sewage treatment plants. But what you do is that, you know, I'm pretty sure it happens here as well, but in most cities around the country, we've got a combined sewage system and water treatment system, which means that water that falls from the sky and water that you flush down the toilet and down your sinks, whatever, they all get treated the exact same way. It's the same cost, but clearly the water that falls from your sky doesn't need to be treated the same way as the water that you flush down your toilet. But that's the way that it happens right now, unfortunately. And so, but any kind you could divert that water, you know, into this type of green infrastructure, you know, you're actually lowering your own municipal costs. And so remember when I talked earlier about how what I'm really interested in seeing, you know, in terms of decreasing the size of our government is by supplying jobs for people, you know, for our most expensive citizens, you know, in green infrastructure, it's this type of work. You know, every time you can cut your costs in, you know, municipal services and stormwater management or air quality, air pollution control, you know, even energy costs, when people lower their, when they can lower their costs, you're providing a major service for your municipality. And you're also increasing and improving your tax base by supplying jobs to people who really need them, and they're no longer taxed. They're actually part of the tax base as opposed to being part of your tax burden. And the other beautiful thing about all this type of work is that there's huge amounts of studies that show that working with plants, horticultural therapy, anytime you work with it or even have access to seeing it, that it has a tremendously beneficial therapeutic effect on people in general. That's why people flip out when they see things like, you know, the natural world around them, and why we suddenly feel restored. And some of those studies, one of my favorite ones is out of the University of Illinois, where they went to, like, in an inner city, one of the most notorious housing projects in the country. It used to be called Cabrini Green. And they did a study where they looked at people who, you know, same income level, everything else, and they had had access to, you know, a little bit of trees and grass, you know, in front of their project. And then the other base that they looked at was people who didn't have any access to trees. And they noticed that the people who were in the community that had access to green space, that the adult stress level was lower, that kids did better in school, that less crime was in the area because people had a tendency to be outside socializing for good things like building community rather than not. And my absolute favorite was the fact that young girls had better self-esteem, teenage girls in particular. And how were they able to prove that? Because the teenage pregnancy rate in the greener side was much lower than it was in the non-green side. And because what studies have shown is that girls that feel as though they have something to look forward to are not trying to get pregnant to have something to care for. They care for themselves first. And so I just love the idea that we can create these type of green infrastructure jobs to support communities, to really create, you know, economic well-being in a local community, to provide the services that we truly need on the municipal level as well.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Majora Carter, MacArthur Genius Fellow and producer of Promised Land. She gave the keynote address at the Classrooms for Climate Conference hosted by the Chugach National Forest and UAA on May 4th.
And imagine what it would be like if all over this country we use green infrastructure as a way to strengthen and support, you know, our cities, lowering our municipal costs as well as lowering our social costs and actually providing jobs with dignity for people who actually need it in their lives. You know, that's the kind of thing I'm so excited about seeing happen more and more as we go. And so all the work I showed you before or most of the work that I showed you before was work that I did with Sustainable South Bronx, an organization I started, you know, many years ago. But I left that back in 2008 to start my own economic development consulting firm because I really wanted to share, you know, the work that I'd done there and pioneered there, because I knew that there are South Bronxes all over this country, all over this world, and that by creating opportunities, you know, and showing folks that you can find ways to really unlock your local economic development potential, that it could support your communities, you know, the residential community and business community, and of course your municipal community as well. And so I'm really excited about working to help develop those kind of local development strategies around the country. But one thing that really the philosophy behind pretty much everything we do is this thing the phrase that I've coined, hometown security. Not to be confused with homeland security, which generally doesn't, you know, evoke feelings of you know, love and togetherness and hometowns. It's more about fear, you know, in most people's eyes. Because I dare say that most people probably don't feel any safer now that there is this Department of Homeland Security. But what I've noticed is that all around the country, there are people that are not waiting for anybody, whether it's big government or big business, to come in to solve the problems of their day. They're looking for really local solutions to help make their hometowns more secure, more happy, more thriving, more filled with love. And that's what I find really special and what I'd really like to hold up for you guys to see as well. Because, you know, we are the keys to our own recovery. We can't give that up to anybody. And so we're starting on the West Coast. And so Andy Lipkus, Los Angeles, California. You know, I know lots of people think LA might have its problems, but a really big one is actually water. You know, it's a pretty dry part of the state, especially down south, you know, where they spend a huge portion, you know, of that state's budget pumping water in and then pumping it out, you know, when it rains as well. And, you know, we know that climate, as it changes, is actually going to help this number go up. The flood insurance costs that they experience, you know, after really heavy rains and not having a way to truly deal with that water. So Andy's organization is all about, it's called Tree People, literally, and it links trees and people. That's their whole goal, and really trying to find ways to support, you know, human development through having a better relationship with trees. And so what Andy found out several years ago was that the Los Angeles School District was planning on spending $2 billion with a B as in boy, you know, to fix LA schools. And he found out that 10% of that budget was specifically to lay down more asphalt and to increase air conditioning, you know, in many of the schools around the district. And what he was able to convince, you know, the folks, you know, in that district to do was if they replaced that much of the asphalt that was already down, that they wouldn't, with green infrastructure, you know, this kind of park-like setting, that they would actually wouldn't need the additional air conditioning. Because this type of green infrastructure actually naturally cooled those school areas. And so it created, you know, it actually absorbed stormwater. You know, the kids had access, you know, to seeing this green space, which meant that their test scores could potentially go up. All things like that. And the fact that there was even, that the money that they were able to save, you know, by creating jobs to take care of this type of horticulture was actually much, I think, a much nicer job than a lot of the other ones would have been. And so moving a little east, we're back in Chicago. Actually, we're quite near where Cabrini Green, the housing project, was another pretty challenged neighborhood called North Lawndale. Brenda was actually charged with providing, with creating a program to keep ex-offenders from going back into jail. You know, and that's a really important thing in this country, considering the expense, you know, of keeping one person in jail for a year, which is way more than going to Harvard. And the fact that chances are that person's going to go right back in. So it's a really big deal to reduce that cost. But anyway, Brenda's job was to figure out a way to do that. And given in the fact that in this country that it's hard enough, you know, for a lot of people to get jobs, but once you've got a record, it's even more difficult. And so how do you talk about that? You know, how do you have skills that you can actually put on a resume and really get you what you need to do so you become a valuable employee? So Brenda had this brilliant idea, obvious maybe to some people, certainly not to me, but she decided to train people to become beekeepers and turn that the honey into skincare products. So through the development, you know, of these folks learning how to care for the bees, harvest the honey, manufacture the skincare product, and then market it, merchandise it, you know, be the people who were actually selling it, they were able to build up their resumes in some really significant ways. Now that product, Beeline, or Beelove, excuse me, is now sold, you know, at Whole Foods in Chicago, also at some of the major hotels there as well, and it's got a really thriving mail order business as well. So all of these things, a very local economic development model, you know, with the added benefit of the fact that, remember that 65% recidivism rate, you know, which is the national average right now, only rather less than 4% of the folks that went through Brenda's program actually went back to jail. So it's a huge, huge thing for that. Down in Appalachia, you know, in coal mining country, you know, there was a woman named Judy Bonds, who was a coal miner's daughter, a coal miner's granddaughter, actually. And Judy, and you know, if anybody would have thought that coal mining, you know, should go on for the rest of our days, it should have been a woman like Judy. But what Judy realized was actually the true economic cost of doing the type of coal mining that her father and her father's father did not do. This kind of coal mining that they do right now is really, except for the actual corporations that own the land and actually own the company, it's really a very toxic thing and doesn't really pay back, you know, the community that it's in. So this type is called, that type of coal mining is called mountaintop removal. So this is just basically any kind of mountain range, you know, in Appalachia. This is what it looks like after the mountaintop removal process. They literally chop off the top of a mountain, you know, dynamite it off, you know, just for a few years worth of coal. And unlike in the days of Judy's father and grandfather, where there were lots of people going down into the mine and whole, you know, communities were supported through that, now it only takes about 24 men for only a few months to go down into those mines, just for a few years worth of coal. So it's not like these are bringing huge amounts of jobs, you know, into this community. You know, I think the unemployment rate there is about 50%. And also, again, these are issues with in terms of the health of people that live in this place. You turn on the tap in parts of that area, you get black tap water, you know, water that is utterly contaminated, you know, with the residue, you know, of that mining operation. But what Judy, you know, and some of her peers discovered was that actually if you left the mountains intact, there was wind up there. The kind of wind that, you know, is not going to go away. And that if you can create wind energy and wind and power jobs, you know, around that, that can really support people, you know, not just for a few months or a few years or even a few decades, but forever. And so when Judy and I met years ago, we swapped t-shirts, you know. I mean, it was really funny to see like a little white lady wearing a green The Ghetto t-shirt. But she was real quick to say, it's like, you know, I'm white and there's a number of white folks around here, but look, this here is a ghetto, because she knew. And so, but the back of my t-shirt, which is hers, was stop mountaintop removal on the front, and the back said, save the endangered hillbilly. So if a hillbilly and a homegirl can understand that this really is about supporting the people in our respective ghettos to thrive and really create local economic development opportunities that they and jobs that they truly have, then I think anybody in the world can. And somebody else who absolutely believes the same thing is Venona LaDuke, you know, from all right, that's what I'm talking about. From Minnesota, you know, I had the pleasure of spending some time with her not that long ago, you know, with the White Earth Land Recovery Project. And it's so interesting because the issue with on the reservations all over the place is that there is often a one-way flow of dollars out of them. You know, lots of problems, you know, everything, you know, from public health problems, really high unemployment, you name it. But the money, like the biggest flows of money going out of those community actually relate to food and energy. And, you know, Winona, in her brilliance, realized that they could actually, they bought us a building where the White Earth Land Recovery Project is actually located, and they were able, you know, with, this is a 30-year-old windmill, and you know, put together with parts from a Renault car, and they were able to actually make this windmill, you know, have enough power, you know, to juice up their entire operation. Now, unfortunately, they are in a bit of a battle, you know, with the utility company who doesn't want them to put it together, so they can't use it just yet, but they will, and I have no doubt that Winona is going to be able to figure that kind of stuff out. But I think just the power, you know, of having, you know, this kind of image, you know, of energy sovereignty, you know, on native lands is, I think, a very powerful image, you know, to keep and just keep in our minds about what we can be doing, you know, in this country as well. Food is also, I mean, if there is ever, you know, a people in this country who have this relationship to the land, I mean, it's the Native Americans who had, like, been a part of it, like, since its inception. And so I got a chance to, I learned how to fillet a fish because of this woman. My mother would be very proud because she was never able to do that. But so to do this was a really wonderful thing. But what they're doing right now is actually tying it to local economic development. They're working with the local farmers there, you know, to literally create food, to have direct farm to school programs, because the kids on the reservations, you know, actually have some of the worst, you know, subsidized food that goes in there. And so, and the fact that there is actually a, that we now know that I think about 17%, you know, of Native communities, you know, actually their rate of diabetes is higher than any other racial or ethnic group in this country. So they have a lot of, they really want to make sure that they're creating healthy food opportunities, you know, to support people as much as they possibly can. And to support the farmers, you know, who also could use that extra market too. And so if you like any of those folks or all of them, please, they're actually all, I had the pleasure of having them all on my National Public Radio show, The Promised Land, which unfortunately I hear is not featured on Alaskan Public Radio, but that's okay because you can find it on the website. And then you could also call Alaskan Public Radio and say, how come this Promised Land show ain't here? I hear it won a Peabody Award and all that. So, you should say that. And it really is beautiful. It's all about visionaries, and we need them. But some of the work, and being inspired, actually when you think about what the work that Winona's doing around food, in their own local community, is just, makes you think about the whole, American food system and how it actually doesn't necessarily support Americans. We know that, because it's highly subsidized, very processed, we know that it actually adds an enormous amount, to our healthcare costs right now. We know that thanks in large part to much of the food or the lack of really healthy food, that this generation, of young people, medical professionals think that this is going to be the first generation that's actually not going to outlive their parents. And that's a really, really scary thought, to think that this is what we've been feeding folks, for a long time at this point, and we've got policies that absolutely support that. And so, then the fossil fuel, economy is absolutely a part of it. So whether it's through transportation or even more so, the amount of petrochemicals that go into pesticides and herbicides that go onto our food and which we in turn consume, this is a problem. And I think a lot of folks are starting to realize that, and are really starting to challenge the idea of what our food system can and should be. And so on that note, one of the things that we are really working on doing with my company is starting a national brand of urban-grown produce. And the idea is that, there's a brand because Americans also really like brands, and so we'll develop it under one brand name, and it'll be to create an opportunity for a local food system in metropolitan regions around the country. So you can augment the growing power of traditional regional farmers that we know, even in New York, where you've got actually getting regional produce is considered, from actually several states, the regional farmers still cannot meet the demand for local produce. So what we're doing actually is we want to augment that regional growing power with in-city growing opportunities. So on 1 to 3 acres of land, which may sound really big, but when you think about the vacancy rate in many American cities where there actually was, a manufacturing base that is now gone, you actually have quite a bit of many American cities where you can actually do this. So 1 to 3 acres, using hydroponic technology, so you're not growing in ground, you're growing in land. You're growing in water, with the nutrient-rich mix to feed the plants that grow up. So on the same area, you can actually grow up to 10 times as much produce, as you can growing in traditional growing. But when you combine the regional produce and the urban-grown produce under one name, you have a dependable stream of produce that can feed, the institutions and also the retail establishments in that local area. So you're creating jobs in inner cities where they're desperately needed, doing around production. And this is really amazing, in a place like America, where we used to be a nation of producers. We kind of might have forgotten about that, but that's what we did here once upon a time, and it wasn't that long ago. So we want to bring some of that back, through urban agriculture and starting it there, and then we'll move into food manufacturing and actually added value, to food and to prepare processed foods, but not the nasty kind of processed food that don't make people healthy. That kind of stuff, very, very different. And so we're really excited about that. So I had a really interesting, little conversation that I heard, from a friend of mine just before I walked, in here, that there's actually, your lieutenant governor is kind of flipped out because there's still $3.6 million left in the federal job training money around renewable energy, and they're having trouble finding people to actually apply for this money. And, to know that there, it may seem like, there's just petroleum and natural gas in this great state of Alaska, but there's also amazing opportunities for renewable energy as well. Amazing opportunities. And so you've got a lieutenant governor who's saying, please apply, and you've got opportunities for renewable energy. The beautiful thing about change is that it can happen. That's the whole point. And so, you know, just because we had a fossil fuel-based economy doesn't mean it has to stay that way. And especially if you all can benefit from it. And that's the whole point about where we are. And so I want to, you know, close out, you know, with this particular quote. You know, this is one of my favorites in all of the universe. Dr. King wrote this, you know, it was part of his letter from a Birmingham jail. And it was in response to, you know, a letter that he had received, you know, from a group of white ministers, you know, who I think fearful for his life, was just like, you know, Dr. King, you have to stop on this integration stuff. You have to, like, just pull back a little bit. And this was his response. I hope, sirs, that you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. I hope Alaska is impatient for the kind of future that they can create. Because the world will look to you for all the beautiful things that you can do simply because you decided to really just move forward. I mean, if I see, you know, the fact that, you know, I come from a place where it was really clear that we were, that our place was to support communities that were wealthier than ours, than we were. You know, by having all of this waste infrastructure and power infrastructure and everything else there in order to benefit someone else. And we decided that that is not the kind of future that we wanted. That we wanted to create local economic development opportunities that did not burden us environmentally, economically, or health-wise. And that we wanted to create something that we could be really proud of and that would benefit us and it wouldn't just kill us, frankly. And I absolutely see, so when we think about green infrastructure as a way to do that, you know, I see the same thing right here, you know, in your state, that there are some amazing things that you can do. And I am really excited about the possibility of seeing, you know, what are you going to be impatient about developing that's going to benefit you. Thank you very much for your time.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Majora Carter, MacArthur Genius Fellow and producer of Promised Land. She gave the keynote address at the Classrooms for Climate Conference hosted by the Chugach National Forest and UAA on May 4th, 2011. A special thanks to University Advancement at UAA for recording this week's program. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.